Thanks, Matt. Thank you. Finally, we're up and running. I was leaving plenty of time for questions. I hope there will still be plenty of time for questions. But I would also like to thank Nestle Purina for sponsoring this, even though they don't offer herbal products yet. My hope springs eternal, but thank you anyway to Nestle Purina. I've heard a couple of speakers this morning talk about going to the dark side and voodoo medicine. You guys are in big trouble. I hope you find it interesting, and I hope to keep it practical. I hope that's what you're looking for, because that's what I'm going to do, is try to give you some practical concepts to work with. Just to give you a roadmap for where we're going, we're going to talk really about why herbal medicine is different from what you've been trained in, and advantages, disadvantages, and as I say, some practical concepts. Can you raise your hand if you're using herbs in practice right now? Wow, that's a lot of you. So maybe you can help me with this lecture as we go along as well. Okay. First, just some background. You know, how many people are using herbs? We're going to look at a survey in human medicine and one in veterinary medicine. This is a survey that was published in about 2005. In Archives and Internal Medicine, so it's a human study. And what they did was phone almost 8,500 people over a number of years from 1998 to 2002. They found that during that period of time, use of herbal supplements went from 14.2% to 18.8%. Is anybody surprised at how small that is, actually? I was. They were specifically dividing herbal supplements out from nutritional supplements, for one thing, because a lot more people are using vitamins and nutraceuticals and glucosamine and that sort of thing. The other thing that was probably a surprise was how little it grew, and that is because during this time period, we believe, a lot more information came out about adverse effects of herbs and interactions and when you need to be careful about taking herbs. And so we think that's probably what's going on there. Not unexpectedly, garlic was the top-selling herb, at least when that was written. The herbs that have come and gone as top sellers included St. John's wort and ginseng, and garlic was at that particular moment. But sales were increasing significantly. In veterinary medicine, not much work has been done. This was an internet survey that was done from Germany, asking veterinarians from Austria, Germany, and Switzerland to respond to their survey. They found that of the 189 people who replied, 75% of those were using herbal supplements in practice. This could be a biased survey. They didn't really correct for the types of people using the internet, so it's hard to tell what the true number is in Europe. But interestingly, they were using herbs mostly for chronic problems, which is how most of us got into herbal medicine or even alternative medicine of other types. It's because chronic problems mean that conventional medicine is not working. That's the reason for getting into these, and this is exactly what we're seeing. Less frequently for infections, parasites, because we've got good options for those in conventional medicine. The only reported disadvantage was lack of information on the subject. Just to give you an idea of sales of animal supplements, now this is not just herbal medicine because it's not been divided out here in this country, but sales of animal supplements in the U.S., if we're talking about households with a non-human food chain animal, because this is a big deal. The FDA, up until recently, with the big flap about the legality of sales of herbs for animals, did not differentiate between pets and animals that were going to enter the human food chain. And so anything was dangerous if it was going to enter the human food chain, and to the FDA, that was all animals. When we talk about non-human food chain animals, over 62% of households have this type of pet, and it looks like about a third of those households, the animals are receiving some kind of daily dietary supplement. The people who do these surveys estimated that the animal supplement industry is now a $1 billion industry. Where are pet owners buying these supplements? This is from 2001. May have changed, but not significantly. If you look at this, this is retail. This means health food stores. So people are buying not animal supplements, but all supplements, mostly from health food stores. Here comes mass market. This is Walmart, Walgreens, Kroger, Publix. Over here, multi-level, third behind those others. Now, this is 2001. Again, things could have changed because a lot of these multi-level companies have gotten into trouble, but third behind these major, major sales. After that, practitioners, mail order, and the internet. I found that really surprising. So, We know that people are buying herbal and other supplements over the counter. We know that there are a number of reasons for them to do so. If you can't read this, it says, the truth is, doctor, I'm not a great believer in Western medicine. They have their reasons for buying these. They may believe that there is something really wrong with conventional medicine, and I think we'd all agree there are parts of it where there is something really wrong with it. I think that we see a lot of people who have beliefs that are a little radical. As veterinarians, we are in a position to educate them on proper use of herbs and supplements, and so I hope that's why you're here today. The other surveys say that people use herbs and supplements not because they believe that conventional medicine is bad, but because they believe that they need other tools. They need additional tools. And I think that makes a lot of sense for us as veterinarians as well. So we know why pet owners might be interested in herbs. Why are veterinarians interested in herbs? To give you just some sense of perspective, 25% of modern drugs are derived from plants. Does anybody know any offhand? Can you name a heart drug, for instance? Digitalis, exactly. There are a number of others. If you think of, for instance, a cancer drug, vincristine. There are other ones, lots of them, but those are some shining examples that we use all the time. 75% of our modern drugs are actually derived from a molecule that was the idea of a plant first. So we really are indebted to plants, and the interesting thing is that probably 1% of plants on the earth have been investigated for medicinal effects. Did anybody see Medicine Man with Sean Connery? That's actually real. They say something, I can't remember the number of hectares being destroyed in the rainforest every day, but it's stunning, and we are losing these plants forever. So it's something to be aware of, especially as herbalists, we're aware of those. Well, as veterinarians, we're interested because there's potential. There are a lot of plants out there, and plants have good ideas. We've already proven that because we use some of those drugs. We understand plants because they contain drugs. They contain a bunch of different classes of drugs that we learned about in biochemistry. Alkaloids are one of the biggest class. There are huge numbers of alkaloids in plants. I think 9,000 at last count, something along those lines. Resins, glycosides, think about cardiac glycosides like digitalis. Lipids, think about fixed oils that are nutritional or essential fatty acids that come from plants. Phenols, volatile oils, these are the ones that are really strong. We have to be careful about in cats. So there are a lot of these that we already understand. The difference between plant medicine and pharmacology that we learned in vet school, however, is that these are complex drugs. It's not a single molecule or a single compound. They're complex. The idea is that a single herb contains dozens, if not hundreds, of chemicals. They also contain nutrients. Plants contain vitamins and minerals and lipids and proteins and carbohydrates. And that's important. Even some of the newer things that are beginning to be considered nutrients, like flavonoids, those were not considered nutrients probably 5 years ago, and I just read a new nutrition book that's calling them nutrients. So they're nutritional and they're pharmacologic. And in fact, herbs can fall anywhere on the spectrum where you look at a very pure, unopposed action like a drug. Think, digitalis, the pure isolate from the digoxin, the pure isolate from the plant foxglove, which is digitalis purpurea, or down to foods like, alfalfa, which is a medicinal herb and a really safe one. And herbs can fall anywhere on that spectrum. So, they're complex. They're hard to investigate. By the way, when anybody tells you, you can't do research on an herb, it's complex, tell them, well, we do that on foods every day. Diet research, we do it every day. So, it is possible to do, and now we're just going to go over that disadvantage and talk about advantages of using whole herbs, why herbalists like them that way. And I'm going to give you the take-home message right now, and I'll probably test you on it a couple times during this next 40 minutes or so. The active ingredient of any herb is the herb. Just remember, that's the answer to the question. Okay, so potential advantages of complex drugs, herbs. One possibly is reduced toxicity. So obviously if you take, 30 milligrams of digoxin and 30 milligrams of dried digitalis purpurea, the dried plant is safer because the active ingredients are diluted out. That's really not a big issue for herbalists. We know how to do those conversions dose to dose. Stability is an interesting thing, though, because there are certain constituents that we believe are stable, available, bioavailable, and active when they come in the context of the whole herb, but not when they're extracted. They're examples from some of the flavonoids, aloe vera, some of the carbohydrates that aren't very stable. So that's another advantage to using the whole herb. Bioavailability, this is something that we don't even begin to have a handle on. We don't have a handle on it, frankly, for some of the common food ingredients, so we're not even there on herbs. These are the effects that I really want to concentrate on, are the multiple effects. We call it a polyvalent effect. And in fact, in addition to polyvalent effects, there are synergistic effects. This is the list of ingredients from St. John's Wort. And you probably can't see a lot from where you are, but if you look at some of these white ingredients, gosh, I'm missing, I didn't even put the right colors on all of them. Let's look at the yellow ones. Hyperforin, hypericins, isohypericin, hypericide, phytosterols, protohypericin. These are some of the very medicinal sounding compounds in St. John's Wort. If you look at these green ones, we've got carotenoids, epicatechin, here's epicatechin up here too, fat, flavonoids, choline, provitamin A, quercetin, pectin, protein. These are nutritional ingredients. And then the white ingredients are just sort of a variety of those and other types of ingredients. It's a very complex drug. Now, don't panic. I need to translate this for you. And I've still not been able to figure out a good way to make this table, so I'm just going to go through this really slowly because I want to make the point about a polyvalent action. Anybody here know what St. John's Wort is used for in human medicine? Depression, exactly. Mild to moderate depression. What I got here is some of the various mechanisms that may be at work in depressed patients. And so up here, you'll see a number of different receptors or enzyme systems that we use in drug research to try to modulate depression or the effects of depression. These are 5-HT receptors, dopamine receptors, opiate receptors, benzodiazepine receptors, estrogen receptors, beta-adrenergic receptors, NPYY1 receptors, NMDA receptors, corticotropin-releasing factor receptors. This is release of GABA, dopamine hydroxylase activity, selective serotonin reuptake inhibition, and MAO inhibition. These are all of the different types of mechanisms that are under investigation for depression. If you look down this column here, at the very bottom I have sertraline and paroxetine. These three rows are various compounds contained in St. John's Wort. So if you look across these rows, sertraline, which I think, is that Zoloft? I think that's Zoloft, has two very well-defined mechanisms of activity. It's an SSRI, and sertraline also is a beta-adrenergic agonist. Mild, but still it's there. Paroxetine is an SSRI. That's all it is. Now, the big picture, if you look across this row, and there is a check mark in every single column except for MAO inhibition. Every single column is checked off for St. John's Wort. So the idea here is that a polyvalent action gives the body a buffet to choose from. Whatever's wrong, because we don't know what's wrong. If you talk to people who have been treated by psychiatrists, they tell us this in behavior medicine. Sometimes you just got to keep trying drugs until you find the right one. St. John's Wort has it all. So, what is the active component of St. John's Wort? The herb. The herb. I'll give you a few more chances. Okay, that was polyvalent activity. Here is synergy. Synergy is the combined effects of two chemicals having a greater than expected effect. There are a lot of examples. This is very new research, but there are a lot of examples so far in herbal medicine. They have identified potential for synergy in kava and wormwood. This is sweet wormwood, and St. John's Wort. But I want to just tell you the story of barberry. This was these studies were done by a group at Arizona and Tufts, bacteriology group, and they were studying bacterial resistance. They took this particular herb because it contains this alkaloid called berberine. Berberine is an alkaloid that has antibacterial activity. And when you put the whole barberry extract in a bacterial culture system, apparently what happened was it worked as a whole extract. But if you use berberine, Staphylococcus aureus became resistant quite rapidly. So they went looking, because this is a bacteriology lab. They actually had a molecular library of drug resistance pumps, and they found one called 5-MHC, 5-methoxyhydrocarbon, that Barberry also made. So the plant figured out somewhere along its evolution not only how to kill bugs, but how to kill the bugs that came resistant to it. So plants are pretty smart. So what is the active constituent of Barberry? Thank you. You guys are quick. So from an herbalist point of view, I just want to point out the beauty of the system and why herbalists don't love to see research that takes a single constituent looking for that to be the active drug. Herbs have molecules that we evolved with for millions of years. Plants actually talk to us. We have opioid receptors. Poppies make opioids. We have cannabinoid receptors, like cannabis makes. We have receptors that are responsive to all kinds of things that plants make. So we have a language with plants, and we may have the potential to respond better to plant medicine than to synthetic molecules. It's a potential. We don't know yet. The idea is the organism chooses what it needs from this buffet of molecules, and these molecules have been known as nature's successes when you talk to the phytopharmacognosists. So this is why we like herbs the way we are and don't 100% love some of the research coming out right now. So talk a little bit about the controversies, because you guys have probably seen a lot of these. These pictures are courtesy of Nutramax, the people who make Cosequin and Denosil and Marin and a number of other things. And you can see what a supplement factory should look like. This is not what the neighborhood herbalist place looked like, and that's, you know, it's got its charms as well. But if you're a practitioner in practice, you want to make sure there's good quality control in your herbal pharmacy. One of the things that you can look at is the whole process of quality control. Right here, for instance, at Raw Materials, if you have non-herbalists working to identify the plants and they get it wrong, nothing you do here is going to get the effect you want in practice. There was an example in the 90s of a plant called, well, it was a supplement called Chompers. And Chompers was supposed to be made of a plant called plantain. Plantain is so common, it's everywhere. Very, very, very mild plant. Herbalists love it. There are no side effects. And what happened was a batch came in that sort of looked like plantain, but instead it was digitalis. So people were definitely harmed by this, and it was because they didn't have somebody trained in identification to make sure they had the right plant as a raw material. From there, you've got to have people who know how to put it together for best effect, and I will, when I get to the different forms of the herbs, you'll see what I mean. And then they need to be able to put it in a form that is consistent dose to dose. They need to go back and make sure that they have the ability to check for quality control if anybody reports problems. There are other issues. Aside from starting with the right raw materials and handling them well, there's the adulteration issue. And this has been reported a number of times for Chinese herbs, where in China, it makes perfect sense to take a combination of herbs. Let's just say it's for upper respiratory congestion. So we've got an upper respiratory congestion formula that works pretty well. And if you add just a little bit of an antihistamine or a steroid to it, it does work much better. And the idea, from the Chinese point of view, is that it allows you to have a lower dose of the antihistamine and steroid. Perfectly sensible. Love that. Multimodal therapy, it's what we're about these days, right? Except in China, you don't have to put that on a label. So you import them here, and you get these surprise drugs. And the problem is that it's mostly the ones that have Chinese on the label. The ones that have nothing but Chinese on the label, you should stay away from completely. We tend to, when we use Chinese herbs, buy from these companies. These are American companies. Yes, they do import from China. And yes, there are still problems with the herbs that come from China. But they have pretty good quality control measures in place. So if you're tempted to send somebody to go get a Chinese formula you heard about, make sure that they're going to a place or that you can get for them that has American companies as the suppliers. I just want to give you this website. It is National Animal Supplement Council, www.nasc.cc. I hope that's in your notes. I'm almost sure it is. National Animal Supplement Council, or NASC, was formed in about 2001 when the FDA started making noise about shutting down the animal supplement industry because they didn't differentiate between human food chain animals and non-human food chain animals. This is about 75% of the entire animal supplement industry. There are some outliers. There are some non-member companies. Now, what I do is I recommend that people, if you're going to get into buying supplements, make sure you stick with companies that are members of the NASC. Why? Because they're forced to undergo some major quality control checks, independent checks. They're monitored. Their quality control is excellent. They have an adverse event reporting system, which was what the FDA really wanted from the human supplement industry, and it doesn't have yet from the human supplement industry. And this adverse event reporting system is really pretty amazing. It allows us to learn over into the future what does cause side effects and what doesn't. I stick with these companies because I know that the NASC has done the research and that they're monitoring them. Other companies that are not members could be good companies, maybe not. It's just that you have to do the legwork to figure out if they're good companies or not. To me, it's easier to just stick with these companies. And I'll give you a hint. When you go to the website, click on NASC members, and that's where you'll find member companies. Matt, what time do we stop? 20 minutes. Oh, good. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about how herbalists prescribe herbs. This will be, if you're not into it at all, this will be kind of, it'll look like too many choices. If you've already gotten into it, you may be confused about whether you want to learn Chinese herbs, Western herbs, or just stick with formulas, stick with chemistry. I would challenge you, if you're into phytochemistry, if you're into pharmacology, and believe that you can figure out what kind of a prescription to make for an animal based on chemicals to guess what this plant is and what it does based on those chemicals. It can't be done. We need the historical perspective to tell us what these herbs are good for. This is yarrow, and yarrow has a lot of essential oils in it. It has some astringents in it, and you would not be able to guess by looking at that that it's used mostly as an astringent, but also as a carminative. So the way I prescribe herbs is I try to keep in mind where I know the physiology of the herb, the pharmacology of the herb, how it affects animals and people, and I also fit it against the historical backdrop because there's a lot of information against that historical backdrop. Can you see this? It says, no herbs, no crystals, nothing funny. I just love that guy. The historical backdrop is these traditional systems of medicine. So this is ethnomedicine or ethnopharmacology. And there are a number to choose from. Traditional Chinese medicine is probably the oldest that has a written record, and that's why a lot of people study Chinese medicine. Excuse me. You also have Ayurvedic medicine from India, also has a long written record. It's probably older than TCM. We just don't have as much information throughout the last couple of millennia. Greek and European medicine, basically Greek medicine probably is derived from old information from Ayurveda and TCM, but they developed their own systems. Galen, you've heard of Galen, you've heard of Hippocrates, and this was what was used in Europe actually until about 1400, 1500, when a whole new system came into being. So you can use sort of the Greek-European system that's been sort of hybridized and changed throughout the centuries and is in its own form now in the U.S., which is what a lot of U.S. American Western herbalists use, or you can use TCM, or you can use a combination, which is what a lot of people do. And let me just give you an example of what this would look like. If we have this kitty here who, let's just say she has chronic kidney disease, CKD, and as a phytotherapist, what we're looking for is, of course, to treat her conventionally with what is safe and effective. And by the way, most herbalists, me included, would say we've got to use the conventional medicine that is both safe and effective. If it is effective and not safe, my clients sometimes choose not to use it if it's not safe. So safe and effective. Obviously, rehydrate them. Obviously, the low-phosphorus diet. And then we're going to be using herbs that we believe address renal blood flow, reduce inflammation, may have nice fatty acids in them that do that. They may address the hormonal disturbances, although I'm not convinced that we know that much about them yet. And some of them may have elevated levels of, for instance, B vitamins and potassium, like alfalfa. So this is the way we would approach it. But there aren't very many herbs for us if we approach it that way. And so using traditional medicine, we take a completely different approach. This kitty, can anybody see what she's laying on? A radiator. In traditional medicine, that means she's seeking warmth. She's cold. I mean, does this evoke sort of pictures of the little old lady with the shawl over her? And these cats are exactly like this. They are cold. So we look at that, we go, well, she's cold, and we know she's dry, she's dehydrated. And so we're going to be looking at herbs that in traditional medicine are thought of as warming and yin tonics. In other words, help to rehydrate them. Of course, we're going to use sub-Q fluids. We're going to use diet therapy. Diet therapy, as long as it fits some of our background information, historical background information. And most modern herbalists are going to use some combination of the two, because it's what we have. 20 years from now, when we have a whole bunch of herbs that are well proven, we might choose completely different herbs, but right now this is what we have. Anybody have any questions about that approach and why it seems confusing, but why we do it the way we do? No questions? Yes. Good question. Traditional means traditional medicine, so whatever you use. Modern U.S. herbalists tend to use some kind of what's called an energetic system. Is the patient warm? Is the patient cold? Is the patient dry? So it's still an energetic system is what they call it. But you can use TCM, Ayurvedic, whatever you're comfortable with. But it does take training in any of those systems. Okay, I just want to give you some practical concepts as far as dosing and how to think about these different forms of herbs. I am one of the consultants on Venn, and we get questions every week. What dose do I give of this? And that's not a question that can be answered. What dose of echinacea should I use? You can't answer that question, and I'll tell you why. First of all, let's start with where herbs come from, the parts that are used. We do use all parts. There's flowers, leaf stem, root. There's not, what I don't have up here is bark, but we use all parts. And depending on the part, you've got to treat them differently. But what I want to point out here is that in some herbs, we use the leaf, whole leaf, stem, the herb, we call it aerial parts. For other preparations, we might use the root. So for instance, dandelion, traditionally, the root is used for liver problems, and the leaf and stem is highly diuretic. So when somebody asks me, should I use dandelion for this, I need to know what part are you talking about or what condition are you talking about. Echinacea is the same. Echinacea, they're using the traditional preparation is root. Echinacea purpurea root is not as well proven as echinacea purpurea aerial parts. And in fact, echinacea purpurea has more research behind it because it was mistakenly sent to Germany in the 1930s for further research after somebody here noticed that the American Indians were using echinacea angustifolia. So the traditional herb is angustifolia root, and they've done a lot of research in Germany on both the echinacea purpurea root and the aerial parts. So you have to be careful about what part and what form of the herb that you're using. What do I mean by form? You can use just plain dried herbs that look exactly like this in a Chinese pharmacy. That's exactly what you would take home with you in a brown paper bag. And you would make a tea out of it or a soup out of it. You can take that and put it in a grinder. And then what you have is powdered herbs. And powdered herbs generally you find in capsules. So you can have dried herbs or you can extract them. So I told you that dried herb could be in capsules, but that also could be an extract. Remember I told you can take the dried herb and you can make it into a soup. And that's just exactly like you make soup with meat or whatever. You boil it down so that you've got a concentrated broth. That's exactly how you make a water extract of an herb. Now, this water extract, which is called tea, is not made by multiple boiling down. It's just called an infusion. You pour hot water over it. So you can make herb teas, which are not as strong as what's called a decoction or the herb soup. So herb soups or herb decoctions are very concentrated, and what they will often do after they make this herb soup is they spray it on a surface, collect it, and now you have a very concentrated powder that's put into capsules. So again, on Venn, when somebody asks me, how many capsules of this herb do I give? I can't answer the question unless I know it's an extract or the dried herb. In fact, I can't answer the question unless I know if it's a 5-to-1 extract, a 10-to-1 extract, or a 3-to-1 extract. So that's something you need to know about from the label. And if you can't find that out from the label, run away from that product. There are other types of extracts. This would be an alcohol extract. It says tincture. Usually it's alcohol. It can be other things. I'll tell you about that in just a second. But a tincture is usually an alcohol extract. It can be glycerin or vinegar as well. And this is an oil extract. So you see this in the store. This is for culinary use, but we can do the same thing, for instance, with calendula flowers. And that is a very famous herb used for skin lesions. And it's well extracted in oil, and then you can just put it right on topically. We don't usually use oil extracts orally. The tinctures that I mentioned, you can use an alcohol tincture. And if you've got an herb where you're interested mostly in the lipid-soluble contents, you're going to want a higher alcohol content, as opposed to an herb where you're really interested in the water-soluble constituents, you're going to want one that's lower in alcohol. This is where you have to find a pharmacy that you trust. You have to find a pharmacy that's very good. They know what they're doing. They've studied the literature. They have a lot of experience. And I'll tell you, the one I use, there are lots of good ones out there. I use Herbalist and Alchemist. And they're very veterinarian friendly, even though it's a human company. They're a member of the NASC, even though they don't have to be because they're a human company. There are other ones out there. Where are we? We're in Colorado. Not too close to here that I know of, but there's one on the West Coast called Herb Farm, PHARM. And there are a few other ones out there that are really great. Wise Woman, there are a lot of them, but I use Herbalist and Alchemist because they study the literature. They know which proportions of alcohol to water or glycerin or vinegar work best. Pure glycerin tinctures are out there. There's a company that makes a pure glycerin tincture, and they taste better because glycerin is sweet. The problem is it's not as strong of an extract. It doesn't extract the alcohol, the lipid-soluble components very well. So I'm not very excited about them because it means I have to give more of this glycerin to these animals who don't want it anyway. And then vinegar tinctures, mostly those are used in human medicine, mostly for people who are recovering alcoholics and they're scared of the alcohol. So we don't use a lot of pure vinegar tinctures. Just a note about aromatherapy. I don't use a lot of it. I think there is some potential, but it's not what most people think it is. Aromatherapy is use of the essential oils, the extracted essential oils, which are the things that smell so strongly. So think lavender and peppermint, and you'll know what I mean when I say a plant high in essential oils. They're used in human medicine for massage and to volatilize into the air. I think that in humans there's a whole lot of emotional connections that we don't have in animals. Animals have a completely different sort of take on what they smell. So I don't know how this applies to animal medicine, but they're certainly very powerful because these molecules that are volatilized in the air hit the nasal mucosa and are transported directly to the brain, or they hit receptors in the nasal mucosa that hit receptors in the osmoreceptor center, I think it's called. And they give completely different signals to the brain. So it's very powerful medicine, but I'm not sure that it's a great idea yet in animals until we understand what their take is on it because they're so sensitive. We talked a little bit about extract form limitations and why you really want to use a pharmacy who knows what they're talking about. For instance, this active ingredient stability business, you need to be able to extract the right stuff and then keep it stable. The other thing is maybe we want to use no extract at all. Maybe we want just the dried herb. For instance, slippery elm has some water-soluble fibers we really like. It's great for diarrhea. But it also has physical fibers, cellulose, that you might want to include as well. So there are some that you really might want to give as dried form as opposed to tincturing them. Shelf life. As you can imagine, if you buy that in a health food store, it is going to stay, it's going to degrade, it's going to oxidize pretty quickly. They usually say within 6 months. If you go to the health food store and instead of being a nice bright green, it's kind of this gold sort of washed out color, it's not going to do you any good. Don't bother. You're not going to get good results clinically from it. We like dried herbs and capsules or dried extracts and capsules a little bit better. Usually a company will put an expiration date on it, but the dried extracts and capsules, I generally get 2 to 3 year expiration dates on mine. I like alcohol tinctures because they last probably the longest of all the tinctures, about 2 years. There's some people who say 10 years and some people who say even longer. The advantage to the tinctures is that when you get to the point where you can make formulas, they're easy to mix together. That's why most herbalists have tinctures on their shelves as opposed to the dried herbs. So we talked about that. If you are going to start an herb pharmacy, just a couple of practical things. There is one company making tinctures for animals, for instance, that only sells 1 or 2 ounce bottles. That is not going to be the best way for you to sell it. You will lose money selling it that way. Buy bulk 4, 8, 16 ounce bottles as soon as you can do it. The bigger ones here are 8 ounce bottles, and then I sometimes keep, my shelf actually looks completely different now, but sometimes I keep smaller ones for things I never use. I don't do much of that even anymore. I just decided I'm not going to use those. So buy in bulk. When you do a label, this is the way I do a label. I have an arthritis formula that I really love. My arthritis formula. Now, this is for advanced arthritis. It's not for the dogs who are 9 years old and they're only on glucosamine. I'm going to do something else with those dogs. I'm going to put them on joint diets or fatty acid supplements. I'm going to change their glucosamine to glucosamine chondroitin, and I'm going to do antioxidants. But I'm also going to, later, when they are already on the non-steroidals, we've already got them on an exercise program, we've already got the weight lost, I might add an herb. And this one would be about 1/3 devil's claw, 1/3 prickly ash, and 1/3 one called corydalis, C-O-R-Y-D-A-L-I-S. Why did I say that? Oh, because if I make a label for something like that, the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to say, this is Jake's arthritis formula, colon, and it'll say 33% devil's claw, 33% prickly ash, and 33% corydalis, and then the instructions, you know, give half teaspoon TID. That way, no matter how many ounces I send home, if I'm not there, everybody knows exactly how much is in there, how to make that formula up, so my technicians can make it. Yes? I don't. The alcohol is going to be anywhere from 25% is about the lowest, 22% is the very lowest, up to 80 to 90%. So there's going to be some average in there depending on what you use. But if you're talking about in a 50-pound dog giving a half teaspoon TID, and let's say it's 50% alcohol, that's really not very much. It's a teaspoon and a half of alcohol a day. It's not very much. So, and I think it's worth it when we're talking about the effect on some of these herbs. I will say that in my discharge instructions for every patient that goes out with herbs is a disclaimer. We don't know the long-term safety of herbs. We insist on doing blood work every 6 months. Okay. Also, make sure you have a graduated cylinder. Can't very well do it without a graduated cylinder. I do use funnels, and I have dispensing bottles. 5 minutes. I think we went over that ad nauseum. We don't have to do that. I want to get to dosing. There are a lot of different dosing schemes. And actually, in veterinary herbal medicine, my co-author, who has this amazing left brain, and my left brain just doesn't work like this, she has all these different mathematical formulas, and she can do this. I'm unable to do it. So I'm going to give you the simple form. This is historically what's been done. They would take human doses, and they would say that for pigs, you give 2 times the human dose, up to, for horses, 16 times the human dose, which is considered very high now. I'm not sure that I believe it, but most horse practitioners think that's very high. For dogs, they say you start at a human dose for a large dog and you scale it down. And that is exactly what I've been doing for many years, and it works just fine. So if you remember that, say, a cat or a dog that's 10 pounds or less has a higher metabolic rate because it's got greater surface area, I might use a quarter of the human dose, maybe an eighth of the human dose, but maybe a quarter, which is proportionately more than you would expect because of their greater metabolic rate. And then up to about 80 pounds, I'm using the human dose. So proportionate, it's a little bit greater proportion for the tiny animals. Does that make sense? It's fairly intuitive. I think it's a lot easier than all the formulas. However, if it makes your left brain happy, you can use the formulas. You can do equivalents. You can actually figure out exactly how much herb. So if somebody tells you, I use 1,000 milligrams of this herb TID, and you happen to have an extract sitting on your shelf, you can do these conversions so that if you have a 1 to 5 liquid extract, 5 mils of that 1 to 5 is a gram of the herb, because these are all weight-to-volume extractions. And this is in your notes, and you can kind of sit down and do the math yourself to convince yourself that this is true. But you can do these. If you have one form of the herb and you get a recommendation in another form, you can still do these conversions. Dosing, just take my word for it. Most of the really effective herbs taste terrible. Do not let anybody go home and try to give them to an animal straight. They've got to be hidden. I use Val syrup pretty effectively. You can certainly stick it in baby food. You can stick it in their diet. For dogs on elimination diets, I use jelly. Honey is okay for some dogs. You can put some of the okay tasting ones straight in their food, like alfalfa, but there just aren't very many of those. A lot of people like to make these what they're called troches, which is mixing them with butter and then freezing the butter to make a kind of a tablet. So that's something that might work for you. And just to finish up, how do you choose products? How do you choose a company? I think this is probably in your notes, but I just wanted to go through it with you once. First of all, if people claim it works, especially for animals, we need to ask them how they know. Because there are a lot of companies out there who will give you a copy of an in vitro study. Anybody here heard of evidence-based medicine? Yeah? And how useful is an in vitro study? Really not. Because an herb goes through the mouth, saliva, stomach acid, different abilities to digest, different abilities of an animal's liver to metabolize, and you get different end results. And so an in vitro study really doesn't help us. And there are companies out there who actually don't get it, that in vitro studies aren't that important. So you need to look at the support. Are there real clinical trials? Or if not, is it a traditional use? Is it a traditional use that's pretty well agreed on by most herbalists out there? Or is it a traditional use that was told to one person who went to the Amazon and heard it from one person and that's all we know about it? Is it used by professional herbalists? If there's some consensus on the way it's used, then probably that's a good starting point. If you've got formula design, are there board-certified herbalists? The American Herbalist Guild does certify members. Veterinarians behind the design, or are they biochemists? And I've seen cases where biochemists were behind the design and they had really bad outcomes. Is it appropriately labeled? You need to know the extract form. You need to know scientific names of the herbs in there as opposed to just a common name. And is the company a member of the NASC? To me, these are how you pick an herb company if you're going to look for that kind of supplement to have on your shelves. Finally, if you want to get training, it's not all that easy to get training, but I will tell you that there are some online courses available. I'll probably be part of one of them. Any online course you take, you should look for something where they send you out to experience the herbs, to grow them, to taste them, to take them yourself, because you can't do herbs. You can't learn about them without experiencing it yourself. If you can't read this, it said, Kevin finally gets to use what he learned in his online self-defense class. You've got to learn herbs personally. If you can't get to an online course, take a human herbal medicine course. They're really good and they'll help you kind of get started. I just want to read this one quote from you. It's from The Botany of Desire by Michael Pollan. He says, plants are nature's alchemists, expert at transforming water, soil, and sunlight into an array of precious substances, many of them beyond the ability of human beings to conceive, much less manufacture. While we were nailing down consciousness and learning to walk on 2 feet, they were, by the same process of natural selection, inventing photosynthesis, which is the astonishing trick of converting sunlight into food, and perfecting organic chemistry. As it turns out, many of the plant's discoveries in chemistry and physics have served us well. From plants come chemical compounds that nourish and heal and poison and delight the senses, others that rouse and put to sleep and intoxicate, and a few with the astounding power to alter consciousness, even to plant dreams in the brains of awake humans. So you can tell I like plants a lot. I think we're running late, so I can take questions up front. And then what time do we come back if you're coming back for more herbs? 3:05. Okay, thank you.
Oftentimes, there are several places in the United States that will do it. Pennsylvania, Davis. There are probably a few private practices. Purdue University and the University of Minnesota. When you talk with them, it's probably best to give them a radiograph as well. In terms of costs, at the University of Minnesota with anesthesia and post-procedural radiography, it's about $120 for most females. And for some males, it may be as high as $1,800 to manage them. Just to give you an idea of ones that would work really well, all these stones in this male, it's a perfect lithotripsy candidate. It'll take less than breaking up a stone in a female. The ones that are difficult are these right here, because oftentimes with the male, what I like to do is grab the stones and put them in the urethra and then break them up there, and then I'm most successful. So, has the surgical removal of stones... it's surely on that pathway. I mean, things that you should be expecting to see in the future is that we're now doing extracorporeal shock waves to actually break up stones in the bladder. So we're doing that to break up bladder stones and then just doing voiding ureal hydropropulsion. And who knows what will sort of come with the future. So in terms of choosing things, again, you need to think solving more struvites. And we certainly don't want to go back to the dark age, just to sort of give acknowledgments to those people who sort of helped make this possible. I'm going to say thank you and maybe end it here, and then maybe I'll answer questions independently. Would that be the right thing to do so that you have your...